So, okay, thanks. During my talk, I will try to focus on the dichotomy between long and short GRBs and say, review a bit what are the latest results, the latest important findings about these two classes. And I will expand a bit on what Elliot told a few days ago. So we know that BATSI, which is the instrument, the most sensitive instrument for gamma ray burst research, was a crystal solid state detector on board Compton Gamma Ray Observatory, detected more than about 3,000 gamma ray bursts during its lifetime, and has found this clear bimodality between short and long gamma ray bursts according to the duration. The duration of gamma ray bursts is clearly segregated in two groups, a bigger one which contains about 70-75% of the events. The so-called long gamma ray bursts, they are on average 10-20 seconds and are all above 1-2 seconds, and the sub-second or short gamma ray bursts, which constitute 30-25% of the total. The difference is not only is not confined to the duration. It has a counterpart, a marginal counterpart in the softness, hardness of the gamma ray bursts, namely. Oh yeah, yeah. There's one here. There's one here. Okay, that's fine. Yeah. The thanks. The duration, the difference between long and short is also different in hardness, in spectrum. The short gamma ray bursts tend to have somewhat harder spectra than long gamma ray bursts. Here is a hardness ratio. It's the ratio between the flux in 100-300 keV and 50-100 keV. So it's a measure. It measures the hardness of the spectrum, and clearly there is a marginal harder spectrum in short gamma ray bursts than long gamma ray bursts. So it must be. It is evidently. It looked like it was a real physical significant difference, and it was interpreted as a difference as in progenitors. It must indicate a completely different origin between long and short gamma ray bursts. We now know that long gamma ray bursts probably all come from supernovae, and short gamma ray bursts are not supernovae. But the situation with the most recent SWIFT results has become a bit blurred. It's a bit confused. It's no longer so clear as it is here, as the situation was like in 2000 when BATSI was demised. This is the BATSI situation. By the way,
I'll alert you that I will disagree very much with that conclusion, but I'll wait till you bring up the pieces of that.
You mean with the conclusion that the situation is more confused now?
I believe it's getting clearer.
Okay, I will be happy. In fact, my presentation is aimed at discussing this point, so yes, I will be happy to. By the way, these red points are SACs, BepoSACs gamma ray bursts. BepoSACs was sensitive only to the long gamma ray bursts.
There was a paper that said there was a third population that sat between those.
Yeah, this is the Hungarian scientist. For some reason, now I can't remember his name, but he was our guest here.
Najaros.
Attila. Yeah. Attila, but yeah, there is a Horvat as well. Yeah, they were both guests here at KITP. We discussed this extensively. Yes, that's true.
What is the shortest long gamma ray burst seen associated with the supernova? Do you know?
Those clearly associated with supernovae are all really long.
Like beyond 20 seconds?
Yes.
Okay.
What's the shortest with one of the bumps? Like red bumps?
What was the question?
I would say there is none that's an ambiguous duration burst which is associated with a supernova. I mean, all those clearly associated with supernovae or with bumps are above 10 seconds. So there's, to my recollection, there's none like 4 or 5 seconds long with a supernova signature, with a bump. Yeah, that's right.
My comment that there's a selection effect going on here, and that is certainly the ones with confirmed spectra are very, very nearby, 0.1 and 0.6.
Of course, yes, yeah.
And so you will see them down above background, longer duration, and even the ones with bumps are all less than 0.5, 0.5 or 0.7.
Yes.
So there may be some selection.
Selection, yes. Yeah, sure. And that's because at high redshift, if you detect the optical afterglow, is because the optical afterglow is very luminous, highly beamed, but then it masks the supernova completely. So in order to detect an afterglow, an optical afterglow at high redshift, it has to be a very bright one, a very luminous one, and then it swamps the supernova. So supernovae are usually detected at low redshift when the object, the afterglow, the source is detected anyway, even if it is weak, but then the supernova dominates, can dominate.
What's the longest duration
memory burst
for you? Did not see a supernova?
Okay, let me talk about that. That's a main issue in this talk. I will talk about that. Okay. Yes, we'll see that. Yes, we'll see that definitely.
In the second slot.
Yeah. So this is a summary of what the situation is. This is updated at October 2006, I think. So there are redshift. These are all the GRBs for which we know the redshift. We have a redshift measurement. And so we have redshifts in the x-axis, and in the y-axis there is the isotropic equivalent gamma ray energy. The output in gamma rays, the output of the prompt event, there's no afterglow here, prompt event in gamma rays, computed in isotropic assumption. I mean, it's 4 pi. So the fluence of the gamma ray burst, the observed fluence, times the distance square and 4 pi. It's a spherical assumption. So we know that's not correct. I mean, it is this plot. It is from this plot that we derive the evidence, the physical evidence that there is collimation. We've discussed this with Elliot 2 days ago. He mentioned that there must be collimation, and the reason is that you derive the energy outputs in isotropic assumption here are huge, are above the rest mass energy of a solar mass star. So clearly, these are paradoxically high, I mean, impossibly high energies, and there must be, so the reason, the solution to this paradox of these extremely high energy must be that there is collimation involved. As you can see, short gamma ray bursts, okay, the supernova long gamma ray bursts, the green here are the long gamma ray bursts, the supernova gamma ray bursts, I mean, the gamma ray bursts with a clear spectroscopically identified supernova, associated with a spectroscopically identified supernova are these. I mean, the low redshift ones, clearly. The red points are the short gamma ray bursts, and they are all at lower redshifts than the long gamma ray bursts. The reason is that short gamma ray bursts are more difficult to detect. They have lower fluxes, lower fluences, and so they are detected on average at lower redshifts. Recently, there have been claims and detections of higher redshift gamma ray bursts. It seems that some gamma ray bursts are associated with clusters at redshift higher than 1. It's very difficult to find.
I agree with everything you said, and I would add that I would place one of them at a redshift of 2, and the other one, the one, the heady one, at redshift of at least 2.5, probably 4.6 for the short one. So I would put 2 high redshift short bursts on the plot myself.
Okay, yeah.
Was there any yellow isotopes there?
They're not that different because it appears that they are more highly beamed.
No, sorry, I'm asking, what's the EM isotropic?
Where would those be here?
They will be up higher. Yeah, they will be up there.
So there is clearly there is a trend here, which is which may be a selection effect, although Amati, in one of his papers, or more than one of his papers, argues that there is a real trend here. I mean, one could think that this part of the plot, the lower right corner of the diagram, cannot be occupied because those are the GRBs at very high redshift and very low luminosities, and so you are there is a strong selection effect. So you are strongly hampered, strongly blocked, and the upper left part of the diagram is not occupied because those are the low redshift, high luminosity gamma ray bursts, and these are less numerous because you are exploring smaller volumes. If there is beaming, if there is collimation, the problem is even... Sorry?
If we saw one, we'd die. Yes.
So, luckily, we don't know... Luckily, this part of the plot is not occupied. No, in fact, it is both are problems, because Amati says this is only partially a selection effect. He thinks that the sensitivity of the instruments does not completely justify this selection effect. And this part, problem here, the lack of high luminosity, small redshift gamma ray bursts, is also a problem, because we don't really know the reason. Is it because all GRBs are strongly collimated, and therefore, so at small volumes, we see less objects anyway, regardless of collimation. But if they are collimated, the problem is even worse. So that's...
against volume, they should come out instead of redshift.
Sorry?
It's not volume instead of redshift.
Yeah, that's right. Yes, that may be... Yeah.
This is
a problem, probably.
Right, but if you believe that the numbers of bursts for a given logarithmic interval in EISO are somewhat the same, then there is a hole up there, because you can even go out and redshift to 0.1, 0.2 or so on, there's a hole. And I would agree with Lorenzo that we did a careful Monte Carlo analysis of the threshold for heading, and it does not seem to come close to accounting for the threshold effect in the lower right. And we published such a paper in the Santa Fe conference. But thresholds are always tricky. So
yes, and yeah.
Absolutely sure.
Yeah, and we've got Bazzi, Beppo Sachs, Haiti, Swift. The situation is heterogeneous because there are many detectors, many missions involved. So
one silly question: E gamma ISO, is that just integrated over what range? First.
If I remember correctly, Lorenzo has done this between 1 and 10,000 kV.
Okay, correct. And corrected for redshift and time depth. I mean,
yes.
I assume it's the integrated above the background for the detector.
Yeah, the best you can do. Yes,
okay.
Yes, of course. Yeah, sure.
And as you were saying, Peter, it's in the rest frame. Mm-hmm.
It's in the yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Good.
Yeah. So collimation, there has been a bit of discussion about collimation a few days ago, because recently we've learned that collimation is not... There is an observational feature, signature of collimation and of the presence of a jet. So this is a very naive cartoon of the jet. Whatever is the exploding object, this is the jet which is formed, and... the observer is here, clearly looks toward the jet direction from some location here. So the idea is that if the observer is within the geometrical opening of the jet, at some point you have very highly relativistic plasma flowing along the jet, first with a relatively high Lorentz factor, and then it decelerates by the afterglow, by the time it interacts with the interstellar medium. At some point, the relativistic aberration, namely the relativistic aberration cone of the light, which is one of the over the Lorentz factor equals the physical opening angle of the jet. At that point, an observer looking down the jet sees, is causally connected with the edges, one of the edges, at some point with both edges of the jet. At that point, the afterglow light curve changes. It's no longer a power law, but steepens. It has a break, exhibits a break. This is because the section of the jet no longer increases for the observer, but the plasma still expands. So this results in lower photons per unit time as an observer you receive with respect to a situation in which you see the jet as if it were a sphere. You see, when you are within, when your line of sight is within the jet and you perceive only light from points in turn within the jet, your situation as an observer is not different from the situation of an observer which sees a sphere. It's the same thing. But when the plasma decelerates, then at some point your eye captures photons from the edge of the jet. And at that point, you start seeing the jet, the edge of the jet, obviously. So no, you no longer receive light from an infinite, from a spherical sphere, but only from a confined region. At that point, this converts in an observational situation in which the afterglow first decays like a power law, and then when this causal connection with the edge of the jet occurs, your power law decreases, steepens. And this should happen simultaneously at all frequencies. Obviously, if it is a geometrical effect, it must be achromatic. It must happen at all frequencies at the same time, in the same way. And the argument is that Swift has found some cases, many cases, in which this doesn't happen. So it's not clear. People use it. So this is a textbook case, for example. This is one in which X-rays are the black dots, optical is the red points. There is a steepening. The situation is a bit confused here in X-rays because some error bars are really big, but you can see a steepening of the X-ray. I mean, a deviation. The afterglow here decays first as a power law, and then it deviates. It bends. The same does the optical. So X-rays and optical here are behaving in a reasonably similar way, conducive to a jet geometry idea. So the idea that this can be connected to the geometry, to the jet aperture of the jet, is plausible. The behavior is achromatic. So people had started to compute jet opening angles from the break in the light curves. There is a standard within the standard fireball model. There is a way, a simple, a linear way, to relate the break. You can model here this light curve with a double power law with a break. The time of the break gives you the opening angle of the jet. So people have computed opening angles of the jets in this way by observing steepenings in the afterglow light curves. But then we have cases like this. You clearly see a bending, a steepening in X-rays, and no steepening in the optical. So this is clearly, this challenges, this finding is clearly... The upper light curve is the X-rays. Clearly bends. And the optical, nothing happens in the optical. The error bars in the optical are not small, but you have no bending here. You can exclude a bending, a steepening similar to the one which occurs in the X-rays. It's clearly excluded. You haven't here an achromatic steepening in optical and X-rays.
But we should perhaps mention that the steepening in the X-ray is not as strong as one would expect for a jet break. So I'm very cautious about associating the breaks that don't go to 2.25 to 2.5 in slope with the jet breaks that we saw before Swift error.
I agree with that. I agree with this. And there are, this is a puzzling case, but Peter, for example, was mentioning 2 days ago the fact that there is one GRB in which XRT, the XRT on board Swift, doesn't see a break, but when you observe with a more sensitive instrument with Chandra, you do observe it. So I think the situation is very, very difficult. I would say it's moot. And I would, myself, I would be very careful in deriving opening angles from these light curves. I mean, I'm not sure at this point we clearly know that we can derive opening angles from these data.
Okay, if I could make a little brief soliloquy about this. My picture of this is that before Swift, we had many, many detailed optical observations of light curves. And the bursts from Pepo Sachs and Hetty were the afterglows that were detected were quite bright. The localizations were not as accurate as the XRT, so the other ones we never saw. They were not so many of them. They were followed very carefully for many, many, many days, weeks. But we had very few X-ray observations. Only Pepo Sachs provided them. Chandra did not. Hetty had very, very few of its bursts that Chandra was willing to follow up. So we have almost no X-ray light curves. Now, we have the opposite situation.
Yeah, it's true.
We have X-ray light curves for every bird that Swift sees, and almost no optical observations. And the reasons are several. One is...
attention span of the optical
observer. Well, one is you have a burst every 5 days, and you have, if you go to late times, you have to spend tremendous amounts of telescope time to do the photometry.
Yeah, that's true.
Another burst that's much brighter afterglow is coming along, you go to that one. But in addition, Swift is not detecting fainter gamma ray bursts. Its threshold is the same as BATSE, as Pepo Sachs, as Kitty. But because of the much more accurate afterglow localizations the XRT gives by play, they are finding many fainter optical afterglows, some of which we don't even detect in the optical or the NIR. But if we do, there are many of them very faint, which makes the job tremendously harder than before, and even less are people willing to do it. So we have this ironic situation that to understand the relative X-ray to optical behavior, before we had all these beautiful optical light curves of the afterglow and no X-ray. Now we have these beautiful X-ray afterglow light curves.
Unlimited optical. Yeah.
So my view is there was a correlation found. It works. And now we see that the same behavior is not seen in the X-ray at all. But it doesn't mean that it doesn't work in the optical. We just very rarely have enough optical observations to check this.
Yeah.
The irony is in the cases where we see it in the swept era, there are interval bursts or IPN bursts, the same very bright ones and so on that we saw before. So I think Swift is rummaging around in very messy, very faint afterglows, and hell knows.
Yeah.
My final thing is, I agree with you, it's very puzzling, and there are X-ray afterglows which have breaks that aren't in the optical, whatever they are. There are X-ray afterglows that have flares that aren't in the optical.
Yeah, yes.
There are breaks in the optical that aren't in the X-ray. There are flares in the optical that aren't in the X-ray. I find it very hard not to conclude that the X-ray and the optical have absolutely nothing to do with each other.
Yeah, I agree. So this is
the model of that. I don't...
Yeah, no, this is relevant, obviously. I will soon close this excursus on breaks, but I wanted to mention first, because we've discussed this with Elliot, and so I wanted to give a view of what the situation is, and your discussion, your analysis is very clear, gives a very nice idea, and I wanted to add the fact that this is extremely relevant to the issue of the cosmology. I mean, GRBs have been used for cosmological purposes along with type 1As. In fact, they are claimed to be the high redshift complement of 1As. With 1As at the moment, you can do cosmology up to not even redshift 2. And with GRBs, in principle, you can complete this up to the edge of the universe. But until we clearly understand what's the intrinsic energy output of gamma ray bursts. I mean, if you can compute the opening angle of a jet from these light curves, you can correct the observed isotropic energy outputs I've shown before. I mean, the idea, the exercise you want to do is take these energies and correct them, derive from these the intrinsic gamma ray energies. So you have to correct them for the actual aperture of the jet, for the actual geometry of the source of the gamma ray burst. So these opening angles, these breaks, are extremely precious because they allow you to measure the physical opening angle of the jet and operate the correction for and derive the intrinsic gamma ray energies. So if this doesn't work, I mean, if these breaks, after all, are not directly related or are related to the jet opening angles in a way not so straightforward as we think, this is a problem for the whole cosmological problem, obviously, for the cosmological business. So this is a fundamental problem. fundamental...
Before we begin, let me ask, how are you doing on time?
Yeah.
Because, Don, you know, you're here long enough that we can allow you to give a talk.
Yeah, that's true, yeah. Yeah, we should... Perhaps we should do that. So I will try now to go back to the problem of progenitors and be a bit.
Like to say that there's no problem with the cosmology because the empirical correlation exists, whatever it is. But
more,
Claudio Fermani has shown that the emission duration that Dan Riker and I came up with of the burst itself works equally or even better. So you don't need the jet breaks. You can, the properties of the burst itself are all you need, and it works fabulously. So I do not think whatever comes out of this will damage or have a problem for cosmology with bursts.
Okay. Yeah. So I wanted to go back a bit to the problem of progenitors. So this is a slide on X-ray flashes, just because I will mention an X-ray flash, so I wanted you to at least to have an idea what they are. X-ray flashes are gamma ray bursts, just a softer version of gamma ray bursts. They only emit practically in the X-rays. This is a typical light curve of an X-ray flash. It's similar to a gamma ray burst light curve in everything, but except it's in the X-rays. And if you go to the gamma rays, this object doesn't emit anything, and in fact the flux decreases as energy increases. And these are all different bands from 2 to 300 kV, and the emission is only in the X-rays. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, exactly. These are like, okay, this is like minus 100, 0, 100. So this is like 20 seconds. It's the duration, typical duration of a gamma ray burst, 20 seconds. And as you can see from the histogram aside, clearly they don't have different, I mean, they constitute a single population. They represent the soft tail of the gamma ray burst population. And the reason I mention this is because this is a summary view graph of how the situation is for gamma ray burst supernovae. The top three light curves, the most luminous one, are the three gamma ray burst supernovae. The three supernova light curves, the light curves of the three supernovae associated with classical gamma ray bursts, 98BW, O3LW, and O3DH. They are very similar. Their maxima, the maximum occurs at very similar times. The luminosity is the same within 20-30%. On the lower part of the graph, of the view graph, you see normal supernovae, not associated with gamma ray bursts. They are type 1c supernovae, just like the gamma ray burst supernovae. A common property of gamma ray burst supernovae is that they are all type 1c. And normal type 1c's are very similar, but they are faster, they decline faster, except 97EF, and they are much less luminous. EF is an exception, and O2AP, they are type 1c supernovae, but they are hypernovae. I mean, they have large absorption line widths. They have high kinetic energy. So the only classical type 1c supernova in this view graph is 94i. AP and 97EF are type 1c supernovae, but of high kinetic energy. These three are the high kinetic energy GRB associated supernovae. The red one is 06AJ, supernova 2006AJ, associated with an X-ray flash. So it's the fourth gamma ray burst associated supernova. It's not properly associated with a proper gamma ray burst, but with an X-ray flash. And it is a bit different. It is like, I mean, judging from this plot, it looks like 06AJ is a bridging object between gamma ray burst supernovae and normal type 1c or non-GRB type 1c supernovae. It's an intermediate properties object.
EF, 97EF, and O2AP, are these two of the ones that were observed at late times in the radio to look for? So they don't show any late time radio?
AP is a radio supernova. AP has radio. AP has radio. It's also very, very close by.
Radio supernova or something that looks more like a late time GRB radio
emission? I don't have a... The radio emission of O2AP is extremely... faint. It is under luminous. It has very, very low radio luminosity. But this is because, obviously, O2AP, usually type 1C, Alicia Soderberg has done this survey, a radio survey of type 1C supernovae, and she has found very, very few. AP is a radio detected, but it's very, very close by. It's 8 megaparsecs, so and it is very under luminous in radio.
Is 2006 AJ broadlined, or...
I will show you here. This plot contains the answer to your question. 06AJ, this is the temporal evolution of the photospheric velocity of 06AJ. And again, photospheric velocity you obviously derive from the width of the absorption lines. The absorption lines are wide, not as wide as those as GRB of GRB supernovae, but wider, broader than non-GRB type 1c supernovae. It's intermediate, again, in velocity, in width of absorption lines and in velocity properties. And we've obviously tried to understand whether these supernovae have some aspherics, have some sign of asphericity, which may be which may suggest their ability to form jets. I mean, clearly, if these supernovae form GRB jets, gamma ray jets, you expect them to exhibit some sign of asymmetry, of asphericity. And this is actually an open issue. We are exploring this problem, this asphericity signatures, and this is an example. 98BW, for example, the prototype gamma ray burst supernova, is highly aspherical. This is a comparison of the emission lines in nebular phase fitted with a spherical model and with an aspherical model, and clearly the aspherical model does a much better job. I may expand this in I don't want to dwell on this. We may expand this some other time. 06AJ, instead, is highly symmetrical, is highly spherical, at least from the nebular spectrum. This is taken 200 days, more than 200 days after the explosion. 06AJ spectrum has no sign of asphericity. I mean, the profiles of the emission of the prominent emission lines are very symmetric, and the velocities of the lines are all the same. So the velocity profiles in every species is the same, which is a sign of high symmetry. So this is a summary of how the host galaxies of long gamma ray bursts look like. Without dwelling into the details, the idea here is that all long GRBs are associated with star-forming regions, with spiral or irregular galaxies. They have very clear, very similar environments, star-form, highly star-forming environments, and this is something that In short gamma ray bursts, is not found. I mean, they are very different from short gamma ray bursts in this respect. So, switching rapidly to short gamma ray bursts. Short gamma ray bursts, first of all, do not have, as I was mentioning at the beginning, do not have supernovae. This is a search for supernova in the light curve of two examples, two gamma ray bursts, short gamma ray bursts at low and intermediate redshift, and no supernova. No bright supernova is detected. I mean, these are templates of 98 BW and templates of bright supernovae. No luminous supernovae, except 87A. No evidence of luminous supernova is found in the light curves of short gamma ray burst afterglows. Apart from that, the afterglows, optical X-ray and optical afterglows of short gamma ray bursts are very similar to those of the long ones, very, very similar. Meaning that probably the regardless of the exploding object, which may be very different in short and long, the environment in which the afterglow expands is similar. The expansion of the afterglow is similar in the two classes. This is the first short gamma ray burst detected by the XRT, accurately localized by SWIFT, and it is so that there is the big error circle of the gamma ray instrument, the small error circle of the X-ray instrument. There is a large elliptical galaxy overlapping this error circle, and this has been identified with the host galaxy of the gamma ray burst. So it would be an elliptical, which is unprecedented for long gamma ray burst. From what we knew about long gamma ray burst, the detection.
I agree with that identification.
Okay, let me make the host. The gamma ray burst localization is accurate to within this blue circle. Whatever galaxy within this error circle may be the host galaxy of the gamma ray burst, obviously. So the association with this big one, with the biggest one, is clearly, maybe clearly uncertain. Is probable, but not.
People should know there are 50 galaxies inside that error circle because there are two merging clusters right here.
Yeah. So that's true. I mean, it may be. It's very difficult to type it. I mean, this one you type very, very easily. All of the rest. So these are two examples of spectra of host galaxies of short gamma ray bursts for which you have the optical identification, the optical afterglow. So once you have an optical afterglow, you know the position with sub-arcsecond accuracy. So you can associate a galaxy with the gamma ray burst with higher accuracy. And the idea I want to convey here is that these two host galaxies have similar luminosity, so presumably similar mass, but the star formation rates you derive from the spectra, from the lines of the spectra, are very different. Here you do see star formation emission lines, the Balmer series, the oxygen 2. So this host is star forming, 2 solar masses per year. This host has, you don't have lines, you don't have emission lines, so there is they are very, very faint. So for the star formation rate, you only derive an upper limit of 0.02 solar masses per year. So they can, hosts of short gamma ray bursts, unlike hosts of long gamma ray bursts, exhibit very different environment, star formation-wise. They belong to very different environments. And the new thing I wanted to, one important thing I wanted to note about SWIFT is this one. This is an important slide. This is a short gamma ray burst. This is the main pulse of the gamma ray burst. It's like 0.5 seconds. This is very hard. In the gamma rays, it's clearly detected in gamma rays. This is 15, the full extent of the SWIFT, but it has a second weaker pulse. But then, if you look how the light curve develops, there is a huge softer emission component which rises and decays. And this is a common, and this is very soft, so this is the X-rays, 15-25 kV. It's not seen in gamma rays. And this is a common situation in short gamma ray bursts. This is something that SWIFT has detected first. BATSY was not sensitive to these X-ray domains, not so sensitive, so would catch only the tip of the iceberg, I mean, only the first pulse. But these soft components seem to be a common property of short gamma ray bursts. If you define the hardness ratio as I've shown here, you see the hardness ratio is very high in the first pulse, is a bit lower in the second pulse, and it is definitely low in this extended long emission component. So we have a problem here. If these trailing emission soft components are associated with the main event, are part of the main event, the GRB is no longer short, is 200 seconds. So we have a problem here about the definition of short gamma ray bursts. And the host galaxy is an elliptical, again.
Yeah, just one small thing is, as you know, there was the Bepo-Sachs team, also the HETI team is a little sensitive about getting credit where credit is due relative to SWIFT.
Yeah.
And it was the HETI burst, 05, 07, 09, that first was we recognized the soft component and did a detailed
analysis. I didn't mean, yes, sure.
You said that SWIFT was the first to identify that component.
Yeah, I should have said SWIFT is now, is detecting these things in a rather systematic way. Yes, thanks.
First, last.
Thanks. No, it's true. No, we should give credit to, the proper credit, yes.
So let me ask the question that is physics-oriented. If you go back to the soft emission, why there is a problem? I mean, you will have emission in different wavelengths, and supposedly the plasma cools.
Yes, I agree. No, there's no problem. But then, if this emission belongs to the prompt event, then it's no longer a short gamma ray burst. I mean, all of this... all of this fuss about bimodality having two populations is no longer clear. I mean, it's...
I agree with that, Elena, but I would, you know, as you yourself said, BATSY was not very sensitive to these components. And so if you went back to the energy range that BATSY typically observed, then in most cases these components wouldn't be there, and so you would only be looking at the short spot.
Exactly, yeah.
And so the confusion would be greatly less.
Yeah.
But I think it's also, you may be going to say this, but that property of that soft component is absolutely unique signature of a short gamma ray burst.
Yes.
It's absolutely unique because you do not see that in long gamma ray bursts. And if you have sufficient signal to noise, you find that long component is made up of a whole series of very short spikes that are only some tens of milliseconds long.
Yeah.
So they have the same very, very, you know, short time scale spikes that you see during the short burst, which itself is made up of some few number of these spikes. So I believe that is the solid gold signature of a short gamma ray burst, that long component.
Yeah, and the point is that we don't know, I mean, is that the whole argument about this, the whole point about this is this already an afterglow, or does this belong still to the prompt emission? Is still an internal shock or external shock if we want to adopt this internal versus external?
What is your thinking?
I don't know. I mean, and
I think that's an excellent point. And to the, you know, because it has such millisecond time variability, I think we're forced to conclude that it's part of the prompt.
Of the prompt event. Yes.
And I confess that when I wrote the HETI paper on 05, 07, 09, I interpreted it as part of the afterglow, which I now think was incorrect.
I don't know. I think it's one of the fundamental problems nowadays. And now we will.
How are you doing?
Yes, good. I want. This is the reply to your
To wrap up in 5 minutes.
Yes, I think so. Yes, definitely.
It will require my cooperation.
This is. I want to answer to the question about. Okay, this is an extremely long gamma ray burst. extremely long because the duration is more than 100 seconds. This is shown, the light curve is shown in different bands. And I would say it is extremely similar. So definitely it's a long, but it is extremely similar to what we've seen right now. I mean, a very short initial pulse followed by a softer component, and you see here the same. There is a very bright initial pulse and a softer, very bright component. This is the integral of all bands. The most of the gamma ray burst develops at low energies. So we have a situation similar to that of short gamma ray bursts, except here this burst is extremely close, so the detection is very bright, and it's clearly defined without any doubt as a long gamma ray burst. But the behavior is similar to short gamma ray bursts. So this is the famous one, long, close by, for which no supernova has been detected. This is a problem. This is the light curve, the optical light curve, and there is no sign of rebrightening here. There is no supernova sticking out at 10 or 20 days. Sorry.
Do you have an image of the host?
I don't have an image of the host, but the host is dwarf and star-forming. It's a typical host of a long gamma ray burst. And of a short gamma ray burst. I mean, short gamma ray bursts are hosted by some are hosted by short dwarf star-forming galaxies, except not all short gamma ray bursts. This is the spectrum at the maximum of the supernova, and clearly there is no sign. There are only emission lines from the host galaxy, but there are no signs of lines from the supernova, absorption lines from the supernova. And this is the same view graph I've shown before. If I put the limit to the supernova to 06/06/14, the limit would be here. I mean, the supernova is this bright or lower. I mean, not having seen a supernova means that the supernova, if there is a supernova, that must be this bright or lower.
Was the search done in?
Oh, in the
optical only, or did they go to the infrared?
I think no, there are no infrared. There's just R band.
I'm just wondering.
I don't think there's no
extinction along the lines.
I don't think there is infrared. I don't think there is infrared data. So, and this is my final. So this is a summary of what clearly this GRB has created a problem, right? I mean, it's the first long one, close by one with no supernova. So what is it? So despite being very long, it behaves, its prompt light curve is similar to the short gamma ray burst. In fact, there is more than that. Gehrels argues that the temporal analysis of the gamma ray burst shows temporal lags, smaller or inexistent temporal lags between different energies, which is a typical short-like behavior, short GRB behavior. It's very unlike long gamma ray bursts. So we've heard Nozomu Tominaga some time ago talking about this case and interpreting it as a narrow jet with low, small deposition, energy deposition rate. So they can make supernovae, with that code, they can make supernovae which make very small amounts of nickel. In this case, they find that they can reproduce the behavior of this supernova with 1,000 of solar mass of nickel 56. So you wouldn't see any supernova if the nickel 56 amount is so low. There is a model which I personally like, and I find worth of further investigation, which is the model of King. He thinks that we are seeing here the merging of a neutron star and massive white dwarf. It's a binary system in which the white dwarf is completely disrupted and accreted by the neutron star, and the accretion time is the time sets the duration of the gamma ray burst. So it may be a long time, so the duration is justified in this way, it's 100 seconds. He is able to reproduce this duration, and he brings one physical example of this kind of system, which is a pulsar 1141, which is a relativistic system. So in this system, the masses of the components are known with some precision, being a relativistic system, and one is a white dwarf and the other one is a neutron star. So he points to this system as a possible analog of the GRBO60614 progenitor. And I personally would like also to explore better this possibility, the collapse of an oxygen neon magnesium white dwarf, to make these kind of explosions. We really don't know what these collapses produce. They can produce high energy transients, we just don't know of which kind, of which duration and hardness. So I wonder whether this is an old idea. Uzov had touched a bit on this idea in his 92 paper, in which he elaborated on millisecond pulsar on the formation of gamma ray bursts through millisecond pulsar formations, merger of white dwarf systems with formation of a neutron star and a pulsar, and that may give rise to a gamma ray burst. So the idea is already there in an embryon way, and I think this is a good hint for further investigation. So I leave, this is the summary, I will leave it there.
Which is, last year when we had this discussion, that there was some ambiguity as to whether there was any evidence at all for beaming in the short arc burst.
Yeah.
And it's sort of important for those that want to make, for those that want to have these double neutron stars, they really need to know this number. So if you can just tell us briefly.
There is at least one case, there is at least one GRB, one short GRB, 05-12-21A, which has a very nice, well-sampled X-ray light curve. That one exhibits XRT, swift XRT light curve, that exhibits a bending, a steepening. However, there's no counterpart, I mean, there's no measurable counterpart in the optical. So, concerning this problem of achromaticity, the problem is still open. But there is evidence, evidence of steepening is present in short gamma ray burst afterglows. Yes?
Any where that's true at more than one wavelength? Or achromat?
The point is, in that case, which is to my knowledge the best X-ray sampled case for short gamma ray burst, the optical light curve is just not long enough. It's the issue is inconclusive because the optical is not sampled to the same extent as the X-rays.
Okay, so let's cycle again. So we will take a 5-minute break and.